Chapter 7. Cyprian over Beck Wells. A literary mosaic. From my boyhood I have had an intense and overwhelming conviction that my real vocation lay in the direction of literature. I have, however, had a most unaccountable difficulty in getting any responsible person to share my views. It is true that private friends have sometimes, after listening to my effusions, gone the length of remarking, "Really, Smith, that's not half bad." Or, "You take my advice, old boy, and send that to some magazine." But I have never on these occasions had the moral courage to inform my advisor that the article in question had been sent to well-nigh every publisher in London, and had come back again with a rapidity and precision which spoke well for the efficiency of our postal arrangements. Had my manuscripts been paper boomerangs, they could not have returned with greater accuracy to their unhappy dispatcher. Oh, the vileness and utter degradation of the moment, when the stale little cylinder of closely written pages, which seemed so fresh and full of promise a few days ago, is handed in by a remorseless postman. And what moral depravity shines through the editor's ridiculous plea of, and of space. But the subject is a painful one, and a digression from the plain statement of facts which I originally contemplated. From the age of 17 to that of 23 I was a literary volcano in a constant state of eruption. Poems and tales, articles and reviews, nothing came amiss to my pen. From the great sea serpent to the nebular hypothesis, I was ready to write on anything or everything, and I can safely say that I seldom handled a subject without throwing new lights upon it. Poetry and romance, however, had always the greatest attractions for me. How I have wept over the pathos of my heroines, and laughed at the comicalities of my buffoons. Alas! I could find no one to join me in my appreciation, and solitary admiration for oneself, however genuine, becomes satiating after a time. My father remonstrated with me too on the score of expense and loss of time, so that I was finally compelled to relinquish my dreams of literary independence, and to become a clerk in a wholesale mercantile firm connected with the West African trade. Even when condemned to the prosaic duties which fell to my lot in the office, I continued faithful to my first love. I have introduced pieces of word painting into the most commonplace business letters which have, I am told, considerably astonished the recipients. My refined sarcasm has made defaulting creditors writhe and wince. Occasionally, like the great Silas Wegg, I would drop into poetry, and so raise the whole tone of the correspondence. Thus what could be more elegant than my rendering of the firm's instructions to the captain of one of their vessels? It ran in this way, Rom England. Captain, you must steer a course directly to Madeira, land the casks of salted beef, then away to Tenerife. Pray be careful, cool, and wary with the merchants of Canary. When you leave them, make the most of the trade winds to the coast. Down it you shall sail as far as the land of Calabar, and from there you'll onward go to Bonny and Fernando Po, and so on for 4 pages. The captain, instead of treasuring up this little gem, called at the office next day, and demanded with quite unnecessary warmth what the thing meant, and I was compelled to translate it all back into prose. On this, as on other similar occasions, my employer took me severely to task, for he was, you see, a man entirely devoid of all pretensions to literary taste. All this, however, is a mere preamble, and leads up to the fact that after 10 years or so of drudgery I inherited a legacy which, though small, was sufficient to satisfy my simple wants. Finding myself independent, I rented a quiet house removed from the uproar and bustle of London, and there I settled down with the intention of producing some great work which should single me out from the family of the Smiths, and render my name immortal. To this end I laid in several quires of foolscap, a box of quill pens, and a sixpenny bottle of ink, and having given my housekeeper injunctions to deny me to all visitors, I proceeded to look round for a suitable subject. I was looking round for some weeks. At the end of that time I found that I had by constant nibbling devoured a large number of the quills, and had spreading out to such advantage, what with blots, spills, and abortive commencements, that there appeared to be some everywhere except in the bottle. As to the story itself, however, the facility of my youth had deserted me completely, and my mind remained a complete blank, nor could I, do what I would, excite my sterile imagination to conjure up a single incident or character. In this strait I determined to devote my leisure to running rapidly through the works of the leading English novelists, from Daniel Defoe to the present day, in the hope of stimulating my latent ideas, and of getting a good grasp of the general tendency of literature. For some time past I had avoided opening any work of fiction, because one of the greatest faults of my youth had been that I invariably and unconsciously mimicked the style of the last author whom I had happened to read. Now, however, I made up my mind to seek safety in a multitude, and by consulting all the English classics to avoid the danger of imitating anyone too closely. I had just accomplished the task of reading through the majority of the standard novels at the time when my narrative commences. It was, then, about 9:40 on the night of the 4th of June, 1886, that, after disposing of a pint of beer and a Welsh rarebit for my supper, I seated myself in my armchair, cocked my feet upon a stool, and lit my pipe, as was my custom. Both my pulse and my temperature were, as far as I know, normal at the time. I would give the state of the barometer, but that unlucky instrument had experienced an unprecedented fall of 42 inches, from a nail to the ground, and was not in a reliable condition. We live in a scientific age, and I flatter myself that I move with the times. Whilst in that comfortable lethargic condition which accompanies both digestion and poisoning by nicotine, I suddenly became aware of the extraordinary fact that my little drawing room had elongated into a great salon, and that my humble table had increased in proportion. Round this colossal mahogany were seated a great number of people who were talking earnestly together, and the surface in front of them was strewn with books and pamphlets. I could not help observing that these persons were dressed in a most extraordinary mixture of costumes, for those at the end nearest to me wore peruke wigs, swords, and all the fashions of 2 centuries back. Those about the center had tight knee breeches, high cravats, and heavy bunches of seals, while among those at the far side the majority were dressed in the most modern style, and among them I saw, to my surprise, several eminent men of letters whom I had the honor of knowing. There were 2 or 3 women in the company. I should have risen to my feet to greet these unexpected guests, but all power of motion appeared to have deserted me, and I could only lie still and listen to their conversation, which I soon perceived to be all about myself. "Egad!" exclaimed a rough, weather-beaten man, who was smoking a long churchwarden pipe at my end of the table, "my heart softens for him. Why, gossips, we've been in the same straits ourselves. Gadzooks, never did mother feel more concern for her eldest born than I, when Rory Random went out to make his own way in the world." "Right, Tobias, right," cried another man, seated at my very elbow. "By my troth, I lost more flesh over poor Robin on his island than had I the sweating sickness twice told. The tale was well nigh done, when in swaggers my lord of Rochester, a merry gallant, and one whose word in matters literary might make or mar. "Defoe, quoth he, hasta a tale on hand? "Even so, your lordship, I returned. "A right merry one, I trust, quoth he. "Discourse unto me concerning thy heroine, a comely lass, Dan, or I mistake. "I replied, "there is no heroine in the matter. "Split not your phrases, quoth he. "Thou weighest every word like a scald attorney. Speak to me of thy principal female character, be she heroine or no. "My lord, I answered, _THERE is no female character. _THEN out upon thyself and thy book too. _he cried. _HOU hadst best burn it. And so out in great dudgeon, whilst I fell to mourning over my poor romance, which was thus, as it were, sentenced to death before its birth. Yet there are 1,000 now who have read of Robin and his man Friday, to one who has heard of my Lord of Rochester. Very true, Defo, said a genial-looking man in a red waistcoat, who was sitting at the modern end of the table. But all this won't help our good friend Smith in making a start at his story, which, I believe, was the reason why we assembled. The dickens it is, stammered a little man beside him, and everybody laughed, especially the genial man, who cried out, Charlie Lamb, you'll never alter. He would make a pun, if he were hanged for it. That would be a case of altering, returned the other, on which everybody laughed again. By this time I had begun to dimly realize in my confused brain the enormous honor which had been done me. The greatest masters of fiction in every age of English letters had apparently made a rendezvous beneath my roof, in order to assist me in my difficulties. There were many faces at the table whom I was unable to identify, but when I looked hard at others I often found them to be very familiar to me, whether from paintings, or from mere description. Thus between the first two speakers, who had betrayed themselves as Defoe and Smollett, there sat a dark, saturnine corpulent old man, with harsh prominent features, who I was sure could be none other than the famous author of Gulliver. There were several others of whom I was not so sure, sitting at the other side of the table, but I conjecture that both Fielding and Richardson were among them, and I could swear to the lantern jaws and cadaverous visage of Lawrence Sterne. Higher up I could see among the crowd the high forehead of Sir Walter Scott, the masculine features of George Eliot, and the flattened nose of Thackeray, while amongst the living I recognized James Payne, Walter Bezat, the lady known as Ouida, Robert Louis Stevenson, and several of lesser note. Never before, probably, had such an assemblage of choice spirits gathered under one roof. Well, said Sir Walter Scott, speaking with a pronounced accent, ye ken the old proverb, sirs, _OWER money cooks, _er as the border minstrel sang, _BLACK Johnstone why his troopers 10 might mak the heart turn cauld, but Johnstone when he's a lane is warer 10,000 fauld. The Johnstones were one of the Redesdale families, second cousins of the Armstrongs, and connected by marriage to, perhaps, Sir Walter, interrupted Thackeray, you would take the responsibility off our hands by yourself dictating the commencement of a story to this young literary aspirant. Nah, cried Sir Walter, I'll do my share, but there's Charlie over there as full o' what as a radical's full o' treason. He's the laddie to give a cheery opening to it. Dickens was shaking his head, and apparently about to refuse the honor, when a voice from among the moderns, I could not see who it was for the crowd, said. Suppose we begin at the end of the table and work round, anyone contributing a little as the fancy seizes him? Agreed, cried the whole company. And every eye was turned on Defoe, who seemed very uneasy, and filled his pipe from a great tobacco box in front of him. Nay, gossips, he said, there are others more worthy, but he was interrupted by loud cries of oh, no, from the whole table, and Smollett shouted out, stand to it, Dan, stand to it. You and I and the dean here will make 3 short tacks, just to fetch her out of harbor, and then she may drift where she pleases. Thus encouraged, Defoe cleared his throat, and began in this way, talking between the puffs of his pipe. My father was a well-to-do yeoman of Cheshire, named Cyprian Overbeck, but, marrying about the year 1617, he assumed the name of his wife's family, which was Wells, and thus I, their eldest son, was named Cyprian Overbeck Wells. The farm was a very fertile one, and contained some of the best grazing land in those parts, so that my father was enabled to lay by money to the extent of 1,000 crowns, which he laid out in an adventure to the Indies with such surprising success, that in less than 3 years it had increased fourfold. Thus encouraged, he bought a part share of the trader, and, fitting her out once more with such commodities as were most in demand, viz. Old muskets, hangers and axes, besides glasses, needles, and the like, he placed me on board as supercargo to look after his interests, and dispatched us upon our voyage. We had a fair wind as far as Cape de Verde, and there, getting into the northwest trade winds, made good progress down the African coast. Beyond sighting a Barbary rover once, whereat our mariners were in sad distress, counting themselves already as little better than slaves, we had good luck until we had come within 100 leagues of the Cape of Good Hope, when the wind veered round to the southward, and blew exceeding hard, while the sea rose to such a height, that the end of the main yard dipped into the water, and I heard the master say that, though he had been at sea 4, 5, and 30 years, he had never seen the like of it, and that he had little expectation of riding through it. On this I fell to wringing my hands and bewailing myself, until the mast going by the board with a crash, I thought that the ship had struck, and swooned with terror, falling into the scuppers and lying like one dead, which was the saving of me, as will appear in the sequel. For the mariners, giving up all hope of saving the ship, and being in momentary expectation that she would founder, pushed off in the long boat, whereby I fear that they met the fate which they hoped to avoid, since I have never from that day heard anything of them. For my own part, on recovering from the swoon into which I had fallen, I found that, by the mercy of Providence, the sea had gone down, and that I was alone in the vessel. At which last discovery I was so terror-struck, that I could but stand wringing my hands and bewailing my sad fate, until at last taking heart, I fell to comparing my lot with that of my unhappy camarados, on which I became more cheerful, and descending to the cabin, made a meal off such dainties as were in the captain's locker. Having got so far, Defoe remarked that he thought he had given them a fair start, and handed over the story to Dean Swift, who, after premising that he feared he would find himself as much at sea as Master Cyprian over Beck Wells, continued in this way. For 2 days I drifted about in great distress, fearing that there should be a return of the gale, and keeping an eager lookout for my late companions. Upon the 3rd day, towards evening, I observed to my extreme surprise that the ship was under the influence of a very powerful current, which ran to the northeast with such violence that she was carried, now bows on, now stern on, and occasionally drifting sideways like a crab, at a rate which I cannot compute at less than 12 or 15 knots an hour. For several weeks I was borne away in this manner, until one morning, to my inexpressible joy, I sighted an island upon the starboard quarter. The current would, however, have carried me past it had I not made shift, though single-handed, to set the flying jib so as to turn her bows, and then clapping on the sprit-dash sail, studding sail, and foresail, I clewed up the halyards upon the port side, and put the wheel down hard a starboard, the wind being at the time northeast half east. At the description of this nautical maneuver I observed that Smollett grinned, and a gentleman who was sitting higher up the table in the uniform of the Royal Navy, and who I guessed to be Captain Marriott, became very uneasy, and fidgeted in his seat. By this means I got clear of the current, and was able to steer within 1/4 mile of the beach, which indeed I might have approached still nearer by making another tack, but being an excellent swimmer, I deemed it best to leave the vessel, which was almost waterlogged, and to make the best of my way to the shore. I had had my doubts hitherto, as to whether this newfound country was inhabited or no, but as I approached nearer to it, being on the summit of a great wave, I perceived a number of figures on the beach, engaged apparently in watching me and my vessel. My joy, however, was considerably lessened when on reaching the land I found that the figures consisted of a vast concourse of animals of various sorts who were standing about in groups, and who hurried down to the water's edge to meet me. I had scarce put my foot upon the sand before I was surrounded by an eager crowd of deer, dogs, wild boars, buffaloes, and other creatures, none of whom showed the least fear either of me, or of each other, but, on the contrary, were animated by a common feeling of curiosity, as well as, it would appear, by some degree of disgust. A second edition, whispered Lawrence Stern to his neighbor. Gulliver served up cold. Did you speak, sir? Asked the dean very sternly, having evidently overheard the remark. My words were not addressed to you, sir, answered Stern, looking rather frightened. They were nonetheless insolent, roared the dean. Our reverence would fain make a sentimental journey of the narrative, I doubt not, and find pathos in a dead donkey, though faith, no man can blame thee for mourning over thy own kith and kin. Better that than to wallow in all the filth of Yahoo land, returned Stern warmly, and a quarrel would certainly have ensued, but for the interposition of the remainder of the company. As it was, the dean refused indignantly to have any further hand in the story, and Stern also stood out of it, remarking with a sneer that he was loth to fit a good blade onto a poor handle. Under these circumstances, some further unpleasantness might have occurred had not Smollett rapidly taken up the narrative, continuing it in the third person instead of the first. Our hero, being considerably alarmed at this strange reception, lost little time in plunging into the sea again, and regaining his vessel, being convinced that the worst which might befall him from the elements would be as nothing compared to the dangers of this mysterious island. It was as well that he took this course, for before nightfall his ship was overhauled, and he himself picked up by a British man of war, the Lightning, then returning from the West Indies, where it had formed part of the fleet under the command of Admiral Benbow. Young Wells, being a likely lad enough, well-spoken and high-spirited, was at once entered on the books as officer's servant, in which capacity he both gained great popularity on account of the freedom of his manners, and found an opportunity for indulging in those practical pleasantries for which he had all his life been famous. Among the quartermasters of the Lightning there was one named Jedediah Anchorstock, whose appearance was so remarkable that it quickly attracted the attention of our hero. He was a man of about 50, dark with exposure to the weather, and so tall that as he came along the tween decks he had to bend himself nearly double. The most striking peculiarity of this individual was, however, that in his boyhood some evil-minded person had tattooed eyes all over his countenance with such marvelous skill that it was difficult at a short distance to pick out his real ones among so many counterfeits. On this strange personage Master Cyprian determined to exercise his talents for mischief, the more so as he learned that he was extremely superstitious, and also that he had left behind him in Portsmouth a strong-minded spouse, of whom he stood in mortal terror. With this object he secured one of the sheep which were kept on board for the officer's table, and pouring a can of rumbo down its throat, reduced it to a state of utter intoxication. He then conveyed it to Anchorstock's berth, and with the assistance of some other imps, as mischievous as himself, dressed it up in a high nightcap and gown, and covered it over with the bedclothes. When the quartermaster came down from his watch, our hero met him at the door of his berth with an agitated face. Back, quote Mr. Anchorstock, apostrophe said he, back, quote can it be that your wife is on board? Apostrophe, apostrophe, back, quote wife. Apostrophe roared the astonished sailor. Back quote ye white-faced swab, what do you mean? Apostrophe back quote if she's not here in the ship it must be her ghost, apostrophe said Cyprian, shaking his head gloomily. Back quote I and the ship. How in thunder could she get into the ship? Why, master, I believe as how you're weak in the upper works, d'ye see, to as much as think o' such a thing. My pole is moored head and starn, behind the point at Portsmouth, more'n 2,000 mile away. Apostrophe apostrophe back quote upon my word, apostrophe said our hero, very earnestly, back quote I saw a female look out of your cabin not 5 minutes ago. Apostrophe apostrophe back quote aya, Mr. Anchorstock, apostrophe joined in several of the conspirators. Back quote we all saw her, a spanking looking craft with a dead light mounted on one side. Apostrophe apostrophe back quote sure enough, apostrophe said Anchorstock, staggered by this accumulation of evidence, back quote my Polly's starboard eye was doused forever by Long Sue Williams of the Hard. But if so be as she be there I must see her, be she ghost or quick. apostrophe with which the honest sailor, in much perturbation and trembling in every limb, began to shuffle forward into the cabin, holding the light well in front of him. It chanced, however, that the unhappy sheep, which was quietly engaged in sleeping off the effects of its unusual potations, was awakened by the noise of this approach, and finding herself in such an unusual position, sprang out of the bed and rushed furiously for the door, bleating wildly, and rolling about like a brig in a tornado, partly from intoxication and partly from the nightdress which impeded her movements. As Anchorstock saw this extraordinary apparition bearing down upon him, he uttered a yell, and fell flat upon his face, convinced that he had to do with a supernatural visitor, the more so as the Confederates heightened the effect by a chorus of most ghastly groans and cries. The joke had nearly gone beyond what was originally intended, for the quartermaster lay as one dead, and it was only with the greatest difficulty that he could be brought to his senses. To the end of the voyage he stoutly asserted that he had seen the distant Mrs. Anchorstock, remarking with many oaths that though he was too woundily scared to take much note of the features, there was no mistaking the strong smell of rum which was characteristic of his better half. It chanced shortly after this to be the king's birthday, an event which was signalized aboard the Lightning by the death of the commander under singular circumstances. This officer, who was a real fair-weather jack, hardly knowing the ship's keel from her ensign, had obtained his position through parliamentary interest, and used it with such tyranny and cruelty that he was universally execrated. So unpopular was he that, when a plot was entered into by the whole crew to punish his misdeeds with death, he had not a single friend among 600 souls to warn him of his danger. It was the custom on board the king's ships that upon his birthday the entire ship's company should be drawn up upon deck, and that at a signal they should discharge their muskets into the air in honor of his majesty. On this occasion word had been secretly passed round for every man to slip a slug into his firelock instead of the blank cartridge provided. On the boatswain blowing his whistle the men mustered upon deck and formed line, whilst the captain, standing well in front of them, delivered a few words to them. "WHEN I give the word, apostrophe," he concluded, "YOU shall discharge your pieces, and by thunder, if any man is a second before, or a second after his fellows I shall trice him up to the weather rigging." With these words he roared "FIRE. Apostrophe on which every man leveled his musket straight at his head, and pulled the trigger. So accurate was the aim, and so short the distance, that more than 500 bullets struck him simultaneously, blowing away his head and a large portion of his body. There were so many concerned in this matter, and it was so hopeless to trace it to any individual, that the officers were unable to punish anyone for the affair, the more readily as the captain's haughty ways and heartless conduct had made him quite as hateful to them as to the men whom they commanded. By his pleasantries and the natural charm of his manners our hero so far won the good wishes of the ship's company that they parted with infinite regret upon their arrival in England. Filial duty, however, urged him to return home and report himself to his father, with which object he posted from Portsmouth to London, intending to proceed thence to Shropshire. As it chanced, however, one of the horses sprained his off foreleg while passing through Chichester, and as no change could be obtained, Cyprian found himself compelled to put up at the Crown and Bull for the night. "Odd spodikins," continued Smollett, laughing, "I never could pass a comfortable hostel without stopping, and so, with your permission, I'll e'en stop here, and whoever wills, may lead friend Cyprian to his further adventures. Do you, Sir Walter, give us a touch of the Wizard of the North?" With these words Smollett produced a pipe, and filling it at Defoe's tobacco pot, waited patiently for the continuation of the story. "If I must, I must," remarked the illustrious Scotchman, taking a pinch of snuff, "but I must beg leave to put Mr. Wells back a few hundred years, for of all things I love the true medieval smack. To proceed then." Our hero, being anxious to continue his journey, and learning that it would be some time before any conveyance would be ready, determined to push on alone mounted on his gallant gray steed. Traveling was particularly dangerous at that time, for besides the usual perils which beset wayfarers, the southern parts of England were in a lawless and disturbed state which bordered on insurrection. The young man, however, having loosened his sword in his sheath, so as to be ready for every eventuality, galloped cheerily upon his way, guiding himself to the best of his ability by the light of the rising moon. He had not gone far before he realized that the cautions which had been impressed upon him by the landlord, and which he had been inclined to look upon as self-interested advice, were only too well justified. At a spot where the road was particularly rough, and ran across some marsh land, he perceived a short distance from him a dark shadow, which his practiced eye detected at once as a body of crouching men. Reining up his horse within a few yards of the ambuscade, he wrapped his cloak round his bridle arm, and summoned the party to stand forth. "WHATO, my masters!" he cried. "ARE bet so scarce, then, that ye must hamper the high road of the king with your bodies? Now, by St. Ursula of Alpixera, there be those who might think that birds who fly o' nights were after higher game than the moorhen or the woodcock. "BLADES and targets, comrades!" exclaimed a tall, powerful man, springing into the center of the road with several companions, and standing in front of the frightened horse. "WHO is this swashbuckler who summons his majesty's lieges from their repose? A very soldado, O truth! Hark ye, sir, or my lord, or thy grace, or whatsoever title your honor's honor may be pleased to approve, thou must curb thy tongue play, or by the seven witches of Gambleside thou may find thyself in but a sorry plight. I prithee, then, that thou wilt expound to me who and what ye are, quoth our hero, whether your purpose be such as an honest man may approve of. As to your threats, they turn from my mind as your caitiff fly weapons would shiver upon my hauberk from Milan. Interrupted one of the party, addressing him who seemed to be their leader. "THIS is a lad of mettle, and such a one as our honest Jack longs for. But we lure not hawks with empty hands. Look ye, sir, there is game afoot which it may need such bold hunters as thyself to follow. Come with us, and take a firkin of canary, and we will find better work for that glaive of thine than getting its owner into broil and bloodshed. For, by my troth, Milan or no Milan, if my curdle acts to but ring against that morion of thine, it will be an ill day for thy father's son." For a moment our hero hesitated as to whether it would best become his knightly traditions to hurl himself against his enemies, or whether it might not be better to obey their requests. Prudence, mingled with a large share of curiosity, eventually carried the day, and dismounting from his horse, he intimated that he was ready to follow his captors. "SPOKEN like a man!" cried he whom they addressed as Alan. "JACKKD will be right glad of such a recruit. Blood and carrion. But thou hast the thews of a young ox, and I swear, by the haft of my sword, that it might have gone ill with some of us hadst thou not listened to reason." "Not so, good Alan, not so," squeaked a very small man, who had remained in the background while there was any prospect of a fray, but who now came pushing to the front. "HADST thou been alone, it might indeed have been so, perchance, but an expert swordsman can disarm at pleasure such a one as this young knight. Well, I remember in the Palatinate how I clove to the chine even such another, the Baron von Slogstaff. He struck at me, look ye, so, but I, with buckler and blade, did, as one might say, deflect it, and then, countering in cart, I returned in tears, and so, St. Agnes save us, who comes here?" The apparition which frightened the loquacious little man was sufficiently strange to cause a qualm even in the bosom of the knight. Through the darkness there loomed a figure which appeared to be of gigantic size, and a hoarse voice, issuing apparently some distance above the heads of the party, broke roughly on the silence of the night. "N.O.W. out upon thee, Thomas Allen, and foul be thy fate, if thou hast abandoned thy post without good and sufficient cause. By St. Anselm of the Holy Grove, thou hadst best have never been born than rouse my spleen this night. Wherefore is it that you 224 and your men are trailing over the moor like a flock of geese when Michaelmas is near? ?" "Captain," said Allen, doffing his bonnet, an example followed by others of the band. "We have captured a goodly youth who was pricking it along the London road. Method that some word of thanks were meet reward for such service, rather than taunt or threat. ?" "Take it not to heart, bold Allen," exclaimed their leader, who was none other than the great Jack Cade himself. "Thou knowest of old that my temper is somewhat chilleric, and my tongue not greased with that unguent which oils the mouths of the lip-serving lords of the land. And you," he continued, turning suddenly upon our hero, "are you ready to join the great cause which will make England what it was when the learned Alfred reigned in the land? Zounds, man, speak out, and pick not your phrases. "I am ready to do aught which may become a knight and a gentleman," said the soldier stoutly. "Taxes shall be swept away," cried Cade excitedly. "The impost, the tithe and the hundred tax. The poor man's salt box and flour bin shall be as free as the nobleman's cellar. Ha! What sayest thou?" "It is but just," said our hero. "But they give us such justice as the falcon gives the leveret," roared the orator. "Down with them, I say, down with every man of them. Noble and judge, priest and king, down with them all." Said Sir Overbeck Wells, drawing himself up to his full height, and laying his hand upon the hilt of his sword. "I cannot follow thee, but must rather defy thee as traitor and feignant, seeing that thou art no true man, but one who would usurp the rights of our master the king, whom may the Virgin protect." At these bold words, and the defiance which they conveyed, the rebels seemed for a moment utterly bewildered. But, encouraged by the hoarse shout of their leader, they brandished their weapons and prepared to fall upon the knight, who placed himself in a posture for defense, and awaited their attack. "There now," cried Sir Walter, rubbing his hands and chuckling, "I've put the shield in a pretty warm corner, and we'll see which of you moderns can take him out. Never a word more will ye get frae me to help him one way or the other. You try your hand, James," cried several voices, and the author in question had got so far as to make an allusion to a solitary horseman who was approaching, when he was interrupted by a tall gentleman a little farther down with a slight stutter and a very nervous manner. "Excuse me," he said, "but I fancy that I may be able to do something here. Some of my humble productions have been said to excel Sir Walter at his best, and I was undoubtedly stronger all round. I could picture modern society as well as ancient, and as to my plays, why Shakespeare never came near "226 Lady of Lyons for popularity. There is this little thing," here he rummaged among a great pile of papers in front of him, "H. That's a report of mine, when I was in India. Here it is. No, this is one of my speeches in the House, and this is my criticism on Tennyson. Didn't I warm him up? I can't find what I wanted, but of course you have read them all, RENZI, and HARLD, and THE last of the barons. Every schoolboy knows them by heart, as poor Macaulay would have said. Allow me to give you a sample. In spite of the gallant knight's valiant resistance, the combat was too unequal to be sustained. His sword was broken by a slash from a brown bill, and he was borne to the ground. He expected immediate death, but such did not seem to be the intention of the ruffians who had captured him. He was placed upon the back of his own charger and borne, bound hand and foot, over the trackless moor, in the fastnesses of which the rebels secreted themselves. In the depths of these wilds there stood a stone building which had once been a farmhouse, but having been for some reason abandoned had fallen into ruin, and had now become the headquarters of Cade and his men. A large cowhouse near the farm had been utilized as sleeping quarters, and some rough attempts had been made to shield the principal room of the main building from the weather by stopping up the gaping apertures in the walls. In this apartment was spread out a rough meal for the returning rebels, and our hero was thrown, still bound, into an empty outhouse, there to await his fate. Sir Walter had been listening with the greatest impatience to Bulwer Lytton's narrative, but when it had reached this point he broke in impatiently. "We want a touch of your own style, man," he said. "He animal-magnetico-electro-hysterical-biological-mysterious sort of story is all your own, but at present you are just a poor copy of myself, and nothing more." There was a murmur of assent from the company, and Defoe remarked, "Truly, Master Lytton, there is a plagueway resemblance in the style, which may indeed be but a chance, and yet methinks it is sufficiently marked to warrant such words as our friend hath used." "Perhaps you will think that this is an imitation also," said Lytton bitterly, and leaning back in his chair with a morose countenance, he continued the narrative in this way. "Our unfortunate hero had hardly stretched himself upon the straw with which his dungeon was littered, when a secret door opened in the wall, and a venerable old man swept majestically into the apartment. The prisoner gazed upon him with astonishment not unmixed with awe, for on his broad brow was printed the seal of much knowledge, such knowledge as it is not granted to the son of man to know. He was clad in a long white robe, crossed and checkered with mystic devices in the Arabic character, while a high scarlet tiara marked with the square and circle enhanced his venerable appearance. "My son," he said, turning his piercing and yet dreamy gaze upon Sir Overbeck, "all things lead to nothing, and nothing is the foundation of all things. Cosmos is impenetrable. Why then should we exist?" Astounded at this weighty query, and at the philosophic demeanor of his visitor, our hero made shift to bid him welcome, and to demand his name and quality. As the old man answered him his voice rose, and fell in musical cadences, like the sighing of the east wind, while an ethereal and aromatic vapor pervaded the apartment. "I am the eternal non-ego," he answered. "I'm the concentrated negative, the everlasting essence of nothing. You see in me that which existed before the beginning of matter many years before the commencement of time. I am the algebraic underscore x underscore which represents the infinite divisibility of a finite particle." Sir Overbeck felt a shudder, as though an ice-cold hand had been placed upon his brow. "WHAT is your message?" he whispered, falling prostrate before his mysterious visitor. "Tell you that the eternities beget chaos, and that the immensities are at the mercy of the divine Anang. Infinitude crouches before a personality. The mercurial essence is the prime mover in spirituality, and the thinker is powerless before the pulsating inanity. The cosmical procession is terminated only by the unknowable and unpronounceable. May I ask, Mr. Smollett, what do you find to laugh at?" "Gadzooks, master," cried Smollett, who had been sniggering for some time back. "It seems to me that there is little danger of anyone venturing to dispute that style with you." "It's all your own," murmured Sir Walter. "And very pretty too," quoth Lawrence Stern, with a malignant grin. "Ray, sir, what language do you call it?" Lytton was so enraged at these remarks, and at the favor with which they appeared to be received, that he endeavored to stutter out some reply, and then, losing control of himself completely, picked up all his loose papers, and strode out of the room, dropping pamphlets and speeches at every step. This incident amused the company so much that they laughed for several minutes without cessation. Gradually the sound of their laughter sounded more and more harshly in my ears. The lights on the table grew dim and the company more misty, until they and their symposium vanished away altogether. I was sitting before the embers of what had been a roaring fire, but was now little more than a heap of gray ashes, and the merry laughter of the august company had changed to the recriminations of my wife, who was shaking me violently by the shoulder, and exhorting me to choose some more seasonable spot for my slumbers. So ended the wondrous adventures of Master Cyprian over Beck Wells, but I still live in the hopes that in some future dream the great masters may themselves finish that which they have begun. John Barrington Cole South, it might seem rash of me to say that I ascribe the death of my poor friend, John Barrington Coles, to any preternatural agency. I am aware that in the present state of public feeling a chain of evidence would require to be strong indeed before the possibility of such a conclusion could be admitted. I shall therefore merely state the circumstances which led up to this sad event as concisely and as plainly as I can, and leave every reader to draw his own deductions. Perhaps there may be someone who can throw light upon what is dark to me. I first met Barrington Coles when I went up to Edinburgh University to take out medical classes there. My landlady in Northumberland Street had a large house, and, being a widow without children, she gained a livelihood by providing accommodation for several students. Barrington Coles happened to have taken a bedroom upon the same floor as mine, and when we came to know each other better we shared a small sitting room in which we took our meals. In this manner we originated a friendship which was unmarred by the slightest disagreement up to the day of his death. Cole's father was the colonel of a Sikh regiment, and had remained in India for many years. He allowed his son a handsome income, but seldom gave any other sign of parental affection, writing irregularly and briefly. My friend, who had himself been born in India, and whose whole disposition was an ardent tropical one, was much hurt by this neglect. His mother was dead, and he had no other relation in the world to supply the blank. Thus he came in time to concentrate all his affection upon me, and to confide in me in a manner which is rare among men. Even when a stronger and deeper passion came upon him, it never infringed upon the old tenderness between us. Coles was a tall, slim young fellow, with an olive, vellus was like face, and dark, tender eyes. I have seldom seen a man who was more likely to excite a woman's interest, or to captivate her imagination. His expression was, as a rule, dreamy, and even languid. But if in conversation a subject arose which interested him, he would be all animation in a moment. On such occasions his color would heighten, his eyes gleam, and he could speak with an eloquence which would carry his audience with him. In spite of these natural advantages he led a solitary life, avoiding female society, and reading with great diligence. He was one of the foremost men of his year, taking the senior medal for anatomy, and the Neil Arnott prize for physics. How well I can recollect the first time we met her. Often and often I have recalled the circumstances, and tried to remember what the exact impression was which she produced on my mind at the time. After we came to know her my judgment was warped, so that I am curious to recollect what my UNBISSED sick instincts were. It is hard, however, to eliminate the feelings which reason or prejudice afterwards raised in me. It was at the opening of the Royal Scottish Academy in the spring of 1879. My poor friend was passionately attached to art in every form, and a pleasing chord in music, or a delicate effect upon canvas, would give exquisite pleasure to his highly strung nature. We had gone together to see the pictures, and were standing in the Grand Central Salon, when I noticed an extremely beautiful woman standing at the other side of the room. In my whole life I have never seen such a classically perfect countenance. It was the real Greek type, the forehead broad, very low, and as white as marble, with a cloudlet of delicate locks wreathing round it, the nose straight and clean cut, the lips inclined to thinness, the chin and lower jaw beautifully rounded off, and yet sufficiently developed to promise unusual strength of character. But those eyes, those wonderful eyes. If I could, but give some faint idea of their varying moods, their steely hardness, their feminine softness, their power of command, their penetrating intensity suddenly melting away into an expression of womanly weakness. But I am speaking now of future impressions. There was a tall, yellow-haired young man with this lady, whom I at once recognized as a law student with whom I had a slight acquaintance. Archibald Reeves, for that was his name, was a dashing, handsome young fellow, and had at one time been a ringleader in every university escapade. But of late I had seen little of him, and the report was that he was engaged to be married. His companion was, then, I presumed, his fiancée. I seated myself upon the velvet settee in the center of the room, and furtively watched the couple from behind my catalogue. The more I looked at her, the more her beauty grew upon me. She was somewhat short in stature, it is true, but her figure was perfection, and she bore herself in such a fashion that it was only by actual comparison that one would have known her to be under the medium height. As I kept my eyes upon them, Reeves was called away for some reason, and the young lady was left alone. Turning her back to the pictures, she passed the time until the return of her escort in taking a deliberate survey of the company, without paying the least heed to the fact that a dozen pair of eyes, attracted by her elegance and beauty, were bent curiously upon her. With one of her hands holding the red silk cord which railed off the pictures, she stood languidly moving her eyes from face to face with as little self-consciousness as if she were looking at the canvas creatures behind her. Suddenly, as I watched her, I saw her gaze become fixed and, as it were, intense. I followed the direction of her looks, wondering what could have attracted her so strongly. John Barrington Cowles was standing before a picture, one, I think, by Noel Paton. I know that the subject was a noble and ethereal one. His profile was turned towards us, and never have I seen him to such advantage. I have said that he was a strikingly handsome man, but at that moment he looked absolutely magnificent. It was evident that he had momentarily forgotten his surroundings, and that his whole soul was in sympathy with the picture before him. His eyes sparkled, and a dusky pink shone through his clear olive cheeks. She continued to watch him fixedly, with a look of interest upon her face, until he came out of his reverie with a start, and turned abruptly round, so that his gaze met hers. She glanced away at once, but his eyes remained fixed upon her for some moments. The picture was forgotten already, and his soul had come down to earth once more. We caught sight of her once or twice before we left, and each time I noticed my friend look after her. He made no remark, however, until we got out into the open air, and were walking arm in arm along Princess Street. "Did you notice that beautiful woman, in the dark dress, with the white fur?" he asked. "Yes, I saw her," I answered. "Do you know her?" he asked eagerly. "Have you any idea who she is?" "I don't know her personally," I replied. "But I have no doubt I could find out all about her, for I believe she is engaged to young Archie Reeves, and he and I have a lot of mutual friends." "Engaged?" ejaculated Coles. "Why, my dear boy," I said, laughing, "you don't mean to say you are so susceptible that the fact that a girl to whom you never spoke in your life is engaged is enough to upset you." "Well, not exactly to upset me," he answered, forcing a laugh. "But I don't mind telling you, Armitage, that I never was so taken by anyone in my life. It wasn't the mere beauty of the face, though that was perfect enough, but it was the character and the intellect upon it. I hope, if she is engaged, that it is to some man who will be worthy of her." "Why," I remarked, "you speak quite feelingly. It is a clear case of love at first sight, Jack. However, to put your perturbed spirit at rest, I'll make a point of finding out all about her whenever I meet any fellow who is likely to know." Barrington Cowles thanked me, and the conversation drifted off into other channels. For several days neither of us made any allusion to the subject, though my companion was perhaps a little more dreamy and distraught than usual. The incident had almost vanished from my remembrance, when one day young Brody, who is a second cousin of mine, came up to me on the university steps with the face of a bearer of tidings. "I say," he began, "you know Reeves, don't you?" Yes. What of him? His engagement is off. Off? I cried. I only learned the other day that it was on. Oh, yes, it's all off. His brother told me so. Deucedly mean of Reeves, you know, if he has backed out of it. For she was an uncommonly nice girl. I've seen her, I said. But I don't know her name. She is a Miss Northcott, and lives with an old aunt of hers in Abercrombie Plus. Nobody knows anything about her people, or where she comes from. Anyhow, she is about the most unlucky girl in the world. Poor soul. Why unlucky? Well, you know, this was her second engagement, said young Brody, who had a marvelous knack of knowing everything about everybody. He was engaged to Prescott, William Prescott, who died. That was a very sad affair. The wedding day was fixed, and the whole thing looked as straight as a die when the smash came. What smash? I asked, with some dim recollection of the circumstances. Why, Prescott's death. He came to Abercrombie Plus one night, and stayed very late. No one knows exactly when he left, but about one in the morning a fellow who knew him met him walking rapidly in the direction of the Queen's Park. He bade him good night, but Prescott hurried on without heeding him, and that was the last time he was ever seen alive. 3 days afterwards his body was found floating in St. Margaret's Lock, under St. Anthony's Chapel. No one could ever understand it, but of course the verdict brought it in as temporary insanity. It was very strange, I remarked. Yes, and deucedly rough on the poor girl, said Brody. Now that this other blow has come it will quite crush her. So gentle and ladylike she is too. You know her personally, then? I asked. Oh, yes, I know her. I have met her several times. I could easily manage that you should be introduced to her. Well, I answered, it's not so much for my own sake as for a friend of mine. However, I don't suppose she will go out much for some little time after this. When she does, I will take advantage of your offer. We shook hands on this, and I thought, no more of the matter for some time. The next incident which I have to relate as bearing at all upon the question of Miss Northcott is an unpleasant one. Yet I must detail it as accurately as possible, since it may throw some light upon the sequel. One cold night, several months after the conversation with my second cousin which I have quoted above, I was walking down one of the lowest streets in the city on my way back from a case which I had been attending. It was very late, and I was picking my way among the dirty loungers who were clustering round the doors of a great gin palace, when a man staggered out from among them, and held out his hand to me with a drunken leer. The gaslight fell full upon his face, and, to my intense astonishment, I recognized in the degraded creature before me my former acquaintance, young Archibald Reeves, who had once been famous as one of the most dressy and particular men in the whole college. I was so utterly surprised that for a moment I almost doubted the evidence of my own senses, but there was no mistaking those features, which, though bloated with drink, still retained something of their former comeliness. I was determined to rescue him, for one night at least, from the company into which he had fallen. Holloa, Reeves, I said. Come along with me. I'm going in your direction. He muttered some incoherent apology for his condition, and took my arm. As I supported him towards his lodgings I could see that he was not only suffering from the effects of a recent debauch, but that a long course of intemperance had affected his nerves and his brain. His hand when I touched it was dry and feverish, and he started from every shadow which fell upon the pavement. He rambled in his speech too, in a manner which suggested the delirium of disease, rather than the talk of a drunkard. When I got him to his lodgings I partially undressed him, and laid him upon his bed. His pulse at this time was very high, and he was evidently extremely feverish. He seemed to have sunk into a doze, and I was about to steal out of the room, to warn his landlady of his condition, when he started up, and caught me by the sleeve of my coat. Don't go, he cried. Feel better when you are here. I am safe from her then. From her, I said. From whom? Her. Her, he answered peevishly. H. You don't know her. She is the devil. Beautiful, beautiful, but the devil. You are feverish and excited, I said. Ryan, get a little sleep. You will wake better. Sleep, he groaned. How am I to sleep when I see her sitting down yonder at the foot of the bed with her great eyes watching and watching hour after hour? I tell you, it saps all the strength and manhood out of me. That's what makes me drink. God help me, I'm half drunk now. You are very ill, I said, putting some vinegar to his temples, and you are delirious. You don't know what you say. Yes, I do, he interrupted sharply, looking up at me. Know very well what I say. I brought it upon myself. It is my own choice. But I couldn't, no, by heaven, I couldn't, accept the alternative. I couldn't keep my faith to her. It was more than man could do. I sat by the side of the bed, holding one of his burning hands in mine, and wondering over his strange words. He lay still for some time, and then, raising his eyes to me, said in a most plaintive voice, why did she not give me warning sooner? Why did she wait until I had learned to love her so? He repeated this question several times, rolling his feverish head from side to side, and then he dropped into a troubled sleep. I crept out of the room, and, having seen that he would be properly cared for, left the house. His words, however, rang in my ears for days afterwards, and assumed a deeper significance when taken with what was to come. My friend, Barrington Coles, had been away for his summer holidays, and I had heard nothing of him for several months. When the winter session came on, however, I received a telegram from him, asking me to secure the old rooms in Northumberland Street for him, and telling me the train by which he would arrive. I went down to meet him, and was delighted to find him looking wonderfully hearty and well. By the way, he said suddenly, that night, as we sat in our chairs by the fire, talking over the events of the holidays, you have never congratulated me yet. On what, my boy? I asked. What? Do you mean to say you have not heard of my engagement? Engagement? No, I answered. However, I am delighted to hear it, and congratulate you with all my heart. I wonder it didn't come to your ears, he said. Tea was the queerest thing. You remember that girl whom we both admired so much at the academy? What? I cried, with a vague feeling of apprehension at my heart. You don't mean to say that you are engaged to her? I thought you would be surprised, he answered. And I was staying with an old aunt of mine in Peterhead, in Aberdeenshire. The Northcotts happened to come there on a visit, and as we had mutual friends, we soon met. I found out that it was a false alarm about her being engaged, and then, well, you know what it is when you are thrown into the society of such a girl in a place like Peterhead. Not, mind you, he added, that I consider I did a foolish or hasty thing. I have never regretted it for a moment. The more I know Kate, the more I admire her and love her. However, you must be introduced to her, and then you will form your own opinion. I expressed my pleasure at the prospect, and endeavored to speak as lightly as I could to Coles upon the subject, but I felt depressed and anxious at heart. The words of Reeves and the unhappy fate of young Prescott recurred to my recollection, and though I could assign no tangible reason for it, a vague, dim fear and distrust of the woman took possession of me. It may be that this was foolish prejudice and superstition upon my part, and that I involuntarily contorted her future doings and sayings to fit into some half-formed wild theory of my own. This has been suggested to me by others as an explanation of my narrative. They are welcome to their opinion, if they can reconcile it with the facts which I have to tell. I went round with my friend a few days afterwards, to call upon Miss Northcott. I remember that, as we went down Abercrombie Place, our attention was attracted by the shrill yelping of a dog, which noise proved eventually to come from the house to which we were bound. We were shown upstairs, where I was introduced to old Mrs. Merton, Miss Northcott's aunt, and to the young lady herself. She looked as beautiful as ever, and I could not wonder at my friend's infatuation. Her face was a little more flushed than usual, and she held in her hand a heavy dog whip, with which he had been chastising a small Scotch terrier, whose cries we had heard in the street. The poor brute was cringing up against the wall, whining piteously, and evidently completely cowed. "So Kate," said my friend, after we had taken our seats, "you have been falling out with Carlo again." "Only a very little quarrel this time," she said, smiling charmingly. "He is a dear, good old fellow, but he needs correction now and then." Then, turning to me, "We all do that, Mr. Armitage, don't we? What a capital thing if, instead of receiving a collective punishment at the end of our lives, we were to have one at once, as the dogs do, when we did anything wicked. It would make us more careful, wouldn't it?" I acknowledged that it would. "Supposing that every time a man misbehaved himself a gigantic hand were to seize him, and he were lashed with a whip until he fainted," she clenched her white fingers as she spoke, "and cut out viciously with the dog whip, it would do more to keep him good than any number of high-minded theories of morality." "Why, Kate," said my friend, "you are quite savage today." "No, Jack," she laughed. "I'm only propounding a theory for Mr. Armitage's consideration." The two began to chat together about some Aberdeenshire reminiscence, and I had time to observe Mrs. Merton, who had remained silent during our short conversation. She was a very strange-looking old lady. What attracted attention most in her appearance was the utter want of color which she exhibited. Her hair was snow-white, and her face extremely pale. Her lips were bloodless, and even her eyes were of such a light tinge of blue that they hardly relieved the general pallor. Her dress was a gray silk, which harmonized with her general appearance. She had a peculiar expression of countenance, which I was unable at the moment to refer to its proper cause. She was working at some old-fashioned piece of ornamental needlework, and as she moved her arms her dress gave forth a dry, melancholy rustling, like the sound of leaves in the autumn. There was something mournful and depressing in the sight of her. I moved my chair a little nearer, and asked her how she liked Edinburgh, and whether she had been there longitude. When I spoke to her, she started and looked up at me with a scared look on her face. Then I saw in a moment what the expression was which I had observed there. It was one of fear, intense and overpowering fear. It was so marked that I could have staked my life on the woman before me having at some period of her life been subjected to some terrible experience or dreadful misfortune. "Oh, yes, I like it," she said, in a soft, timid voice. "And we have been here long, that is, not very longitude. We move about a great deal." She spoke with hesitation, as if afraid of committing herself. "You are a native of Scotland, I presume?" I said. "No, that is, not entirely. We are not natives of any place. We are cosmopolitan, you know." She glanced round in the direction of Miss Northcott as she spoke, but the two were still chatting together near the window. Then she suddenly bent forward to me, with a look of intense earnestness upon her face, and said, "Don't talk to me any more, please. She does not like it, and I shall suffer for it afterwards. Please, don't do it." I was about to ask her the reason for this strange request, but when she saw I was going to address her, she rose and walked slowly out of the room. As she did so, I perceived that the lovers had ceased to talk, and that Miss Northcott was looking at me with her keen, gray eyes. "You must excuse my aunt, Mr. Armitage," she said. "She is odd, and easily fatigued. Come over and look at my album." We spent some time examining the portraits. Miss Northcott's father and mother were apparently ordinary mortals enough, and I could not detect in either of them any traces of the character which showed itself in their daughter's face. There was one old daguerreotype, however, which arrested my attention. It represented a man of about the age of 40, and strikingly handsome. He was clean-shaven, and extraordinary power was expressed upon his prominent lower jaw and firm, straight mouth. His eyes were somewhat deeply set in his head, however, and there was a snake-like flattening at the upper part of his forehead, which detracted from his appearance. I almost involuntarily, when I saw the head, pointed to it, and exclaimed, "There is your prototype in your family, Miss Northcott." "Do you think so?" she said. "I'm afraid you are paying me a very bad compliment. Uncle Anthony was always considered the black sheep of the family." "Indeed," I answered, My remark was an unfortunate one, then. Oh, don't mind that, she said. I always thought myself that he was worth all of them put together. He was an officer in the 41st Regiment, and he was killed in action during the Persian War, so he died nobly, at any rate. That's the sort of death I should like to die, said Coles, his dark eyes flashing, as they would when he was excited. I often wish I had taken to my father's profession instead of this vile pill-compounding drudgery. Come, Jack, you are not going to die any sort of death yet, she said, tenderly taking his hand in hers. I could not understand the woman. There was such an extraordinary mixture of masculine decision and womanly tenderness about her, with the consciousness of something all her own in the background, that she fairly puzzled me. I hardly knew, therefore, how to answer Coles when, as we walked down the street together, he asked the comprehensive question, "Well, what do you think of her?" "I think she is wonderfully beautiful," I answered guardedly. "That, of course," he replied irritably. "Who knew that before you came?" "I think she is very clever too," I remarked. Barrington Coles walked on for some time, and then he suddenly turned on me with a strange question. "Do you think she is cruel? Do you think she is the sort of girl who would take a pleasure in inflicting pain?" "Well, really," I answered, "I have hardly had time to form an opinion." We then walked on for some time in silence. "She is an old fool," at length muttered Coles. "He is mad." "Who is?" I asked. "Why, that old woman, that aunt of Kate's, Mrs. Merton, or whatever her name is." Then I knew that my poor colorless friend had been speaking to Coles, but he never said anything more as to the nature of her communication. My companion went to bed early that night, and I sat up a long time by the fire, thinking over all that I had seen and heard. I felt that there was some mystery about the girl, some dark fatality so strange as to defy conjecture. I thought of Prescott's interview with her before their marriage, and the fatal termination of it. I coupled it with poor drunken Reeve's plaintive cry, "Why did she not tell me sooner?" and with the other words he had spoken. Then my mind ran over Mrs. Merton's warning to me, Cole's reference to her, and even the episode of the whip and the cringing dog. The whole effect of my recollections was unpleasant to a degree, and yet there was no tangible charge which I could bring against the woman. It would be worse than useless to attempt to warn my friend until I had definitely made up my mind what I was to warn him against. He would treat any charge against her with scorn. What could I do? How could I get at some tangible conclusion as to her character and antecedents? No one in Edinburgh knew them except as recent acquaintances. She was an orphan, and as far as I knew, she had never disclosed where her former home had been. Suddenly an idea struck me. Among my father's friends there was a Colonel Joyce, who had served a long time in India upon the staff, and who would be likely to know most of the officers who had been out there since the mutiny. I sat down at once, and, having trimmed the lamp, proceeded to write a letter to the colonel. I told him that I was very curious to gain some particulars about a certain Captain Northcott, who had served in the 41st Foot, and who had fallen in the Persian War. I described the man as well as I could from my recollection of the daguerreotype, and then, having directed the letter, posted it that very night, after which, feeling that I had done all that could be done, I retired to bed, with a mind too anxious to allow me to sleep. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.